Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. I'm one day away from entering New York. Lots of work accomplished. You'll be able to see a lot of this in the upcoming months. Special investigative reports, white papers, documentaries. And today, we're going to continue. I'm on a telephone. We're going to talk about why the privatization of American police is such a dangerous trend by Claire Burnish of Anti-Media. Also, we're going to look at, from our environmental segment, these six big chemical companies now make 50,000 different pesticides. Who knew there are that many? There are. Also, privatization has been a colossal flop. Well, that's according to Dr. Alan Francis in Psychology Today. Chemtrails, the consequences of toxic metals and chemical aerosols on human health by Dr. Sandra Pellegrini. Also, I'm going to share some insights today for those who want to know the truth about the safety of vaccines, in particular on children, but it also will have an impact upon all adults and especially those with vulnerable immune systems, senior citizens. And for all of our listeners in California who are still fighting to get the vaccine bill stopped or altered, you're going to have a lot of specific documentation, pure science, good science. And it is from Dr. Suzanne Humphrey, who has spent thousands and thousands of hours studying the literature. And she will tell us why aluminum in these vaccines is extraordinarily dangerous. You will not believe how much aluminum a young, non-developed immune system of a child receives. It's in the milligrams, which is extraordinarily toxic to the brain and the central nervous system and the mitochondria. So she will explain in depth why aluminum is toxic. Also, I've mentioned many times that we need a government that has laws to protect the consumers, to protect animals, to protect the environment, but also is not a government that believes that we are the enemy, that we are the problem, and therefore is there to facilitate and have citizen oversight. Today, what we have is we have a government that is completely out of control. It is fascistic. It is a police state. It is very similar to what the Italians saw in the early 1920s and the Germans saw in the 1930s. And it's dangerous. The fact that we are over-policed, we are over-militarized, we are spied upon, and if we challenge any of this, we're seen as somehow the enemy of the state and therefore have no rights. That's just dangerous. So what happens when one area of our lives, our financial overseer, the Federal Reserve, the most powerful financial entity in the world, when it is unaccountable for a few million dollars or a few hundred million, maybe even a few billion? No, how about $9 trillion? $9 trillion. Almost unfathomable, that amount of money, let alone what happened to it. Alan Grayson, who was on the program recently, will grill the top overseer of the Federal Reserve, and you'll find out what the answer is. Also, John Stewart on GMOs and patenting seeds. And I want to thank all of the people for listening and sharing documentaries and articles. We have hundreds of millions of visits and people sharing and searching for articles and sharing the films as well. We are the number one listened to progressive radio program in the world. And we don't take it for granted, and that's why we have such diversity every day. Let's begin. We always begin with something that helps everyone all over the world. Now, we know that tuberculosis is a killer disease. About 1.5 million people worldwide die every year of tuberculosis. And it's caused by a mycobacterium. and this is a tuberculosis TB bacterium, and it's a pathogen, and it's serious. Now, according to University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, a very important piece of research, they found that there are implications for development of immune-based therapies to treat tuberculosis, and it's an enzyme in the body that acts as a sensor in the immune system. It's a, called a cyclic GMP-AMP synthesis, and it's essential for the defense against tuberculosis bacterium. That's what the study showed. So when infected with TB, mice lacking this enzyme succumb much quicker than mice with normal CGS activity. Quote, based on this outcome, we believe that modulating the GAS activity could be a novel approach to therapy. Okay. And this was published in a peer review journal of Cell Host and Microbe. So why is this important? Why would I select this to share with you? Because it's they're looking for a drug, a patented drug, that will then be able to stimulate this particular enzyme and therefore better fight the system. Well, for years, those of us in the field, and there are a lot of us in the field, of natural healing, meaning stimulating the body's natural healing process, either by stopping that which impacts the immune system negatively, or using that which enhances it, or combination of both, which is more ideal. Then we start to see that it doesn't matter whether it's tuberculosis, cancer, any condition, even the flu or cold, the stronger your immune system, the healthier your body, the more likely you are to either not get the condition, or if you do, to have it be minimal. Now, that means that you are naturally stimulating your body every single day, your immune system. So you're stimulating this enzyme. If you eat right, meaning eating living foods, high vibrational foods, foods with high energy. I won't go into it in great depth now because we have so much to share on today's program, but I'll just briefly tell you that back in the 1970s, I was doing some research work from a concept, a hypothesis. My hypothesis was simple. If, as a registered dietitian and a nutritionist at the time, we were taught in dietetic school, as all dietitians are, that a calorie is a calorie, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. So if you add, let's say if you had 100 calories from eating white sugar or fructose or an apple, it was all the same. But it wasn't. And common sense dictates if you're eating a white pure carbohydrate that's going to spike your blood sugar, and that's bad. But if you ate an apple, you're getting all of the other approximately 150 phytochemicals and polyphenols and quercetin and fiber, and that's good. But that's not how they saw it. And hence the textbooks that were used clearly were biased and limited. So an entire group of people were going forth every generation with misinformation. And that's why so many tens of thousands of people die every year of malnutrition they contract from being in a hospital. Doctors didn't change it, nurses didn't change it, dietitians didn't change it. But nobody was paying attention to what the other people who are called the vitalists were doing. They were looking at how juicing and natural hygiene were enhancing people. Victor Kolvinskis, one of the greatest natural hygienists in American history, he got his start with Ann Wigmore, and she was the best of the best. Ann knew, starting with her clinic up in Boston, that if she could get people off junk foods and sugar and start feeding their body the blood of plants, mainly the wheatgrass juice and lots of it all day long, that she saw improvements. What she was really seeing was the immune system was getting back on its feet and therefore could fight by stimulating a higher activity in natural killer cells against the cells that were floating in the body, kill them. and to help heal from infections and viruses and bacteria. In fact, at almost all the clinics, they would give you wheatgrass juice with ginger, honey, and you would gargle with that, and it would kill staph, strep, and everything in your throat. And it works today, too. So, for decades, thousands of people in the natural healing field have been using Build Your Immunity Naturally. De-stress, detox, rejuvenate. Simple. Simple in its construct. It's very challenging if a person doesn't want to give up something that's bad for them. So if you were to do that, then if you came in contact with that bacterium, there's a likelihood your body would identify it and kill it. Because every day, you're not even aware of this, you're coming into contact with hundreds of pathogens and chemicals every single day. And if you drive a cab, like a lot of people listening right now are driving cabs and sharing it, they generally have their radio on if it's a land-based station, or they have their phone on speaker if they're listening over the telephone. And but they're breathing in a lot of fumes, and those are toxic fumes. But if they have been juicing with, let's say, green apple, celery and cucumber and lemon, and then if they have their wheatgrass juice or ginger juice, ginger and beet stimulates a healthy blood and chelates in the blood. Taking vitamin C does it also. So now you're stimulating your immune system, cleansing, helping stop bacteria and viruses that otherwise would end up causing you one day to get a cold or flu, or depending upon the virus and or bacterium, even tuberculosis. So if you're traveling around the world, if you're traveling to countries where you're going to be exposed, the key to keeping healthy, stronger immune system. Stay off anything that's pro-inflammatory and take all that which is natural. In any case, I was using a machine that had been brought to me by Dr. Douglas Graff and Dr. Thomas Carruth, and they had been, one was working down at in Philadelphia at Drexel University, and he brought this machine up, and it could measure the energy of a particular plant. So it took about a year, but I was able to measure the difference between a fresh organic apple and a fresh non-organic apple. Apple that I had made into a juice, measure the juice. Apple that was pasteurized, the juice, and one was non-pasteurized. An apple that was dried at low heat, an apple was dried at high heat. An apple that was made into applesauce. In other words, every way you can prepare food, you then measure it to see how did all that change it, the energy. Even if the nutritionist says this, to say, well, what's it matter? Apple juice, apple cider, whole wheat berry, whole wheat to make wheatgrass juice, or a piece of bread made from the wheat, or toast made from, it's all the same. No, it's not. It's not. The single most important lesson to learn today, it is the value of the energy, the level of the vibration of the energy that we don't even study in our society anywhere. No school, no university, no graduate class studies energy. So for those of us who have studied and applied it, because in science you have two sections. You have either basic science or applied science. I've worked in both. And applying something from a hypothesis and seeing it work, you think, aha, because what I found was if you give the standard American diet, hot dogs, hamburgers, meatloaf, you know, French fries, fried chicken, turkey wings or chicken wings and all this other stuff, if you give that to people, then the energy you're giving them is either 0 to about 4. And I found that you have to give energy above 5 on a scale of 0 to 10 to enhance healing. And then the higher above 5 you give it, the more healing it occurs. So if you give organic juices, you're 10. If you give high vibrational foods like wheatgrass, all your juices, lemon juice, your seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, sesame seeds, all those are 9s. Making nut butters, almond, pistachio, but sprouted raw nut butter, 10s. even your salad greens, eights. So if you're feeding people who are sick, 8, 9, and 10, you're giving them healing foods that build up the immune system. If you feed people, as we do today in hospitals and at home, foods that are 0, 1, 2, and 3, you're producing disease. So let's boil it down. It is not just the nutrients. That's the biggest mistake that supposedly smart people make. They think that knowledge is wisdom. It has nothing in the world to do with wisdom. Nothing. Zero. Zip. And hence they think that, well, I've got a degree and it shows as long as I'm giving 20 grams of protein three times a day. Well, give the protein from a living food where the energy is high at about 10% and you're causing a healing at the energy level. If you give it from a steak and you give the, yes, you're giving the body protein, and which are amino acids, the building blocks, a protein, but there's no energy behind it. So we're giving food, we're overfeeding people, and they're undernourishing their energy. Healing, all healing, is a liberation of the energy in the body. Enzymes are part of that, so you're, with the healing energy, you're stimulating enzymes. When you stimulate the enzymes, as the study just showed, you're preventing disease. If this makes sense to you, use it, because you could be preventing heart attacks, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia, and tuberculosis, just to name some, with this concept. I'll do more with it later, because I want to tell you about the day that this top scientist from University of Rome came, and we worked for 6 months on a project on verifying this whole concept of energy, because he had something to add to it. Next, in our discussion of health and healing here today and nutrition, the effect of coenzyme Q10 on the incidence of atrial fibrillation in patients with heart failure. This is from the Renmin, R-E-N-M-I-N, hospital in Wuhan University in China. This was published in the Journal of Investigative Medicine, a major peer-reviewed journal. And, quote, This is from background of the study. There is mounting evidence to support the influence of inflammation and oxidative stress in the pathogenesis of atrial fibrillation, or AF, and heart failure. Then it goes through the methods, the results, and the conclusion. Quote, this is from a major medical journal. Coenzyme Q10 as an adjuvant treatment in patients with atrial fibrillation may attenuate the incidence. The mechanisms of the effect perhaps have relation with the reduced level of, in this case, it's a particular aldehyde. But the bottom line is, it's turning off inflammatory cytokines and helping your heart. So if you have AFib, coenzyme Q10 can save your life. That's the takeaway message, all right? And I know a lot of people in this audience have it. I'm suggesting, for normal usage, 300 milligrams a day, morning, noon, and night. Before you go out to exercise, you always take three. Here's what you must take before you exercise to help prevent a heart attack or stroke. Keep your blood thin. And you should keep your blood thin. Vitamin E, tocotrienols, vitamin C, garlic extract, hawthorn, coenzyme Q10, magnesium and calcium from citrate, and L-carnitine. And cayenne at a high heat unit. That, if every American used that every day, you could just eliminate 500,000 heart attacks and strokes per year. That's my opinion. Because your blood will be thin. I remember once we had in the laboratory, I had at the Institute of Applied Biology, no, excuse me, this was Tri-State Healing Center. There was an argument. Because someone came in, and they would come in every night. And this is one of the people who had advanced AIDS. And all the people with advanced AIDS, and there were 1,200 of them, 1,200 I was working with, they would like come in at night because they were their own support system. And they became friends, and some of their therapies were taken up to 4 hours because it was a big vitamin C drip they were getting, almost 200,000 milligrams. Plus, we had juices going. We'd give them bitter metal and juice. Talk about bitter. This would really make you pucker, because imagine the bitterness of a lemon times 10. That's bitter melon. And bitter melon's very common in the Philippines and also in South America. But it's extremely healing. Man, do you want that if you've got any kind of viruses, Epstein-Barr, herpes, anything. It's one of the most powerful antiviral juice you can have. Looks like a cucumber with little nodules on it. In any case, we were zipping through making all this bitter melon, and then we were using homeopathic zeolites. It was actually a lot of fun because people loved the different aromas and smells and throwing cinnamon in everything and turmeric. And it was like a whole apothecary, but a natural one. And there was Ayurvedics because one of the physicians was an Ayurvedic medical doctor. And had no problem people eating anything. You know, they're right, bring it in. But this one person was always bringing in food that really stunk. And we're trying to encourage people to go to a meatless diet, and this guy was insistent upon having the food, you know. So one evening, this longtime vegan physician said, let's do this test. So he took a sample of the blood of four people in the room, and then he took a sample before and after this guy would eat his, you know, his fried chicken and his milkshake, and showed the results. When you're drinking juices, healthy juices, especially green juices, your blood gets really red, bright red, beet red, because it's oxygenated. That's the way blood should be. It should not be turgid, it should not be dark, and it should never be thick and coagulating. So here this guy sees his blood, and it's got all these strings of fat, and you can just see it before and after. It was so dramatic, and he went, wow, this is scary. And the doctor says, yeah, you know, all that we're doing to try to save you, and you go eat the food that you're eating and eat the sugar and all this other stuff, you're not liberating your whole immune system. And he never did it again because he realized by saying it. So if you could just, could you imagine what you would do differently if you could see the outcome of a man's cells, heart, brain, liver, and kidney cells dying after each hard alcohol beverage you had? Could you imagine if you saw your blood coagulating and clumping, aggregating together instead of flowing freely, of being bright red and healthy, oxygenated, instead of dark and very thick? So anyhow, so for those of you who are healthy and you take that before you go out in the morning, you're lessening your likelihood of a heart attack and stroke. And by the way, don't think because you're a runner. I used to run with Jim Fix, Olympian. He died of a heart attack. And I never will forget one day we had the whole group running, and we meet every Sunday at 90th Street and 5th Avenue in Central Park to show people how to run and power walk. And right in front of us, a guy just dropped, boom, went right down. He had a heart attack. And that's what happens. But if you have that, you can help prevent that. Now, you want to have it again in the evening about an hour before you go to bed, so your blood is thin while you're sleeping, because a lot of heart attacks and strokes occur in the middle of the night. But if you were sick, if you had, depending upon what you had, I'd recommend anywhere from 300 to 500 milligrams three times a day to help your heart. And also, there's another study, and this is from published in the Journal of Pakistan Medical Association from Siraj University Medical Center in Iran. It says the effects of coenzyme Q10 on glycemic control, oxidative stress, and on type 2 diabetes. And again, it gives, like all scientific studies, it gives the objective methods, results, and conclusions. And it says, quote, in conclusions, coenzyme supplementation may reduce oxidative. Well, that means you're less likely to have a heart attack if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic. And another study showed vegetable oil consumption now linked to trans fats and pesticides found within human tissue. And what this really says is that the way we buy these oils, they're now, if they're not organic oils, you buy them in your regular supermarket, then they can contain, quote, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. Those are associated with hormonal defects and disease risk, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and those are known to cause skin loss, and polybrominated diphenyl ethers, and those are flame retardants, by the way, and they can cause cancer and neurobehavior changes. And these are in our mattresses. Recently, someone was at a retreat that I had, and they asked about, you know, gee, this is a firm mattress. And I said, well, yes, it is. And they were looking at the tag, and they said, what fibers? I said, that's made out of palm fibers. Why? I said, because there's no outgassing. What's wrong with outgassing? And then I did a whole discussion about the chemicals that are in your mattress, your pillow, your comforter, your sheets, all that, your breathing, your face is right down on it all night. So I said, this has no chemicals. It's all organic. It's all natural. The mattress, the sheets, the pillows. So this is an environmental free zone. And the person got it. They understood that you're breathing in these chemicals and there's a body cumulative level till one day your body can't process it. So what this is saying is that when you're eating vegetable oils that are not organic, you're getting a lot of these chemicals in there, pesticides in particular. They're only using corn, canola, cottonseed, safflower, peanut oils, and those are not the ones you want. The ones are making the foods not good. And finally, a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of a Lactobacillus acidophilus plus a bifidus against a placebo showed that it helps with hypercholesteremia. And this was published in the Journal of Clinical Diagnosis, meaning in lay language that probiotics can help if you have elevated cholesterol. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Noll. Now we're going to listen to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, former professor of medicine, an orthodox nephrologist, that's a kidney specialist. And when she found questions she could not find answers to, had questions she could not find answers to, she began to do her own homework. And the more she researched, the more concerned she became, until after she spent thousands upon thousands of hours researching all the scientific literature, she was convinced that all the doctors in America, every single physician in America, should do what she did, and they would never give another vaccine. So for all of our friends and all of our listeners in California who are concerned, but you're not a scientist, you're not a physician, and you want to have evidence to take before the committee, please take the segment you're about to hear and send it and to the legislatures and to the media and invite Dr. Humphreys out to give a presentation or to debate any of the doctors, including the doctor who's the sponsor of that bill in California. And by the way, it's New York State. Every single state you're going to see now, the same bill that's in California, because the American Legislative Council, Alex, is behind all this as our big pharma. Now to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys talking about, she pronounces it differently. It's either way is accurate. All of us say aluminum. So when you hear what she's saying, it's aluminum that she's talking about, one of the most dangerous substances on earth. And here's why you should be concerned when your child gets aluminum in a vaccine, what's happening to the child's body.
Vaccines that contain animal DNA, animal genetic matter, and animal cells, and other animal chemicals. Well, we know that vaccines contain substrates from all these animals that I put up here. This is also not controversial at all. For instance, this Cocker Spaniel is really cute, and you might want to have a Cocker Spaniel as a pet, but you should also know that tumorigenic Cocker Spaniel kidney cells are used to propagate vaccines, and that some of those cells do end up in the vaccine media, but we're told not to worry about it because they're only slightly tumorigenic. And that's the flu vaccines. We know that there is human material, fetal material in vaccines. They're also used, lung fibroblasts are used to propagate. Now think about it. If you need to propagate vats and vats of vaccine in order to make it for the entire world, you need to have cells that divide really rapidly so that you can grow viruses on or that you can have bacteria growing on. So that's why we need these cells in order to make the vaccines. Okay, they don't just make themselves. So this chick is also really cute, but it's not really cute necessarily when it's injected into you, and we know that it's a very common substrate for vaccine production. This one here I find rather disturbing. That is a caterpillar, and that is used for the Cervarix human papillomavirus vaccine. Is used propagated through genetic engineering with that caterpillar cell. And these monkeys, again, this has been part and parcel of vaccine production since the earliest times, because these monkey cells, they divide really rapidly and they grow viruses. The polio vaccines are made on them. We still have vaccines made on them today. There have been lots of problems with these monkey kidney cells. Some of them have been worked out, but we don't, you know, if you don't know what can grow inside of an animal cell, you can't necessarily test for it. And even if you look on the vaccine package inserts, you'll see Vero cells listed, and that comes from monkey, and that's a monkey kidney cell. We know that there's cow blood, cow serum, albumin in vaccines, and that they also boil the hides for the gelatin that's in the vaccines as well. These little piggies here, their stomachs are used to get clumps of cells to break apart so that you can plate them out in a petri dish and grow vaccine on it. This was a problem. Just a few years ago, we heard about the rotavirus vaccine growing a porcine circovirus, but we were told not to worry about it because people that eat pork end up with it. So apparently it's okay to give that to your babies, too. There's actually not been very much research of anything I'm aware of as far as any long-term effects of infants consuming porcine circovirus. So how do these things affect your DNA? Your child's DNA function? Well, we don't know because no one's bothered to look at the issue. But consider this. Children received 10 vaccinations in the 1980s before the age of 5. And today, they get 36 vaccines, beginning often in utero or on the first day of life, like we do in the United States. Human brains and human immune systems have definitely changed for the worse, and vaccines can be playing a part. Epigeneticists and vaccinologists say, well, vaccines can train reprogramming, and they want us to look on the bright side. They always want to paint a picture of how the immune system is going to be improved because of this, but that's not what we see, and that's not what much of the medical literature states. Even if vaccines can prevent some infections, considering what's in them, there's no way they can improve overall health. And now they want to give vaccines to pregnant women, which in addition to these animal cells and associated genetic material, also have aluminium in them. And you can see here Dr. Paul Offit, and he's the doctor that I mentioned in the beginning, who says that infants can tolerate 100,000 vaccines at once, theoretically, although there's never been any animal model for that. That's his theory. Well, in the context of medical literature, it's astonishing that one of the most well-published vaccine proponents, Paul Offit, and he's a key opinion person who's the go-to soundbite for the American pro-vaccine movement, that he could publish this on his website. He educates doctors worldwide on vaccination. And on his website, from the Children's Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, the Vaccine Education Center, in April of 2013, you could have gone on there and read about your concerns about aluminium in pregnancy. And you could have been totally set at ease by seeing what this website had to say. Because this quote was on his website, and it said, aluminium is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. It is found in all tissues and also believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus. Well, I PDF'd that web page in April 2013, and I sent it with a link to one of the world's most knowledgeable aluminium experts, who's usually very diplomatic and polite. And he wrote me back stating something not very flattering about Dr. Paul Offit, which I won't repeat here. But wouldn't you think that a man who considers himself highly educated would have read this following quote that was published in 2011? Dr. Kawahara published a very important article that needs to be read by anybody who has concerns about aluminium. And amongst other things in that article, in the very beginning, he says, whilst being environmentally abundant, aluminium is not essential for life. On the contrary, aluminium is a widely recognized neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in humans. He goes into great detail about this. All the other aluminium researchers I know have no time for Dr. Paul Offit's comments. We need to look at vaccines in pregnancy more closely, starting with aluminium, to see what it really does do in the body. Dr. Kawahara's article is very important because it supports, with 176 medical references, the fact that aluminium is a death factor for cells. He reviews the most state-of-the-art techniques that have brought aluminium back to the forefront of Alzheimer's research and tells why and how the old research that said it wasn't related to Alzheimer's is flawed. This picture denotes some of the problems that he has documented and found himself with the action of aluminium in the body. Now remember, the aluminium is a small radius, very highly positively charged element. So it's going to be attracted to negative charges in the body. Because of that, it's able to travel to places where it really should never go. One of those places is into the brain, and we now know that it does cross the blood-brain barrier. It crosses in cells called macrophages, and there are special transport systems that shuttle it through. We also know that aluminium binds to phosphate in DNA and RNA in the nucleus. Remember all that epigenetic stuff? Well, guess what? When that binds to phosphates in the nucleus, it influences many genes and regulates in abnormal ways gene function. We also know that it binds to ATP. That stands for adenosine triphosphate, which you may have heard of. It's the most important energy molecule in your body, and that's what's used to give, you know, for me to move my muscle right now or for you to run up a hill. That's what you need. Well, aluminium binds to that and influences energy metabolism, and we know that people with aluminium excess end up with very low energy. This also here is an enzyme, and that's calcium or magnesium. And you should know that enzymes are dependent upon certain elements. And in order for them to function properly and have the right conformation, they need these elements. Well, because aluminium is such a highly negatively charged particle, it actually has more of an affinity for those enzymes than the normal elements that are supposed to be working with it. So it comes in, pops calcium and magnesium right off, and takes over and essentially inhibits those enzymes. Without enzymes, your metabolism really can't work very well. In addition to making those enzymes useless, the fact that it's now bound onto them keeps it in the body longer. So this makes the half-life of aluminium even longer. Over here, we see this is an example of a protein. And we know that proteins are supposed to, for the most part, be separate, doing their jobs. And when the aluminium comes along, it cross-links them. It essentially works as a tanning agent because it coagulates proteins in this way. And it causes conformational change. And having the right shape in a protein is really important because the shape often determines its function. So those conformational changes can actually inhibit the degradation of those proteins by their particular proteases. So you can't actually even use them the way your body wants to use them. So aluminium is a huge deal when it comes to proper cell function. So if we go back here, let me just remind you that it's important in the development of a healthy fetus, and quantities fluctuate naturally during normal cellular activity. We really have to scrutinize that. The other thing aluminium does is it damages cell membranes. Remember, oh, I'm going to show you another picture in a minute. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. So this is a cell membrane, a representation of it, phospholipids here. The lipids are in the middle and the phosphos are on the outside. And in the presence of iron, some of these lipid membranes can be damaged. And that's why we have our own antioxidant system. But in the presence of aluminium, these pro-oxidant reactions will happen more. So It's called peroxidation. So it's basically like hydrogen peroxide, which actually can be very toxic to cells. So when aluminium comes in with this iron, it will catalyze using certain enzymes and cause problems in that membrane. And remember what I showed you earlier, that the cell membranes and the environment and what's happening in those membranes has everything to do with how genes function and how the cell functions and how cells talk to each other and whether they grow or whether they die or differentiate and turn into different cells, or whether they turn into cancer. Have a look at this schematic of a cell membrane, which is actually more realistic appearing than the one you saw before. And consider that each of your cells has around 100,000 switches, which have what are called receptors and effectors, meaning it has a signal comes in and then it has an action, okay? Now, that opens and closes to various substances on the outside, and it transmits signals to the inside, telling the nucleus what to do. Then consider the fact that after aluminium exposure, the membranes and the myelin, which is very important for nerve function, become stiff and dysfunctional. Dr. Verstraeten wrote two articles that are really important that detailed in his experimental models showing how the membranes changed in the face of aluminium. And Dr. Kawahara listed several pages of the biological processes that are significantly altered during low levels of aluminium. And he talked about three of them with medical references and how they change the lipid and phospholipids in the body, how they change the physical properties of this membrane, and how they change this membrane fluidity. I think of this as like the kind of car wash that you can go through that has the flaps that go down. And so your proteins are needing to move through this like it's fluid. It's almost like it's a matrix that these proteins can pop up and they can come back down and they can migrate. And it's very important that they're able to move around the way they're supposed to and that this area stays functional. So when you toss aluminium into that, everything changes. The signals that are coming through are altered. Now, this slide looks like a handful, but I'm going to explain everything in it to you. I'm going to explain this slide in detail. So this DAMPS stands for damage-associated molecular patterns. And these are basically things that your cells recognize as alarm signals. And in response to that, they secrete chemicals called cytokines, which recruit other cells which come and clean up the mess and deal with it, okay? And in that process can be very inflammatory. And then the anti-inflammatory side comes down and dampens it down. This is called pathogen-associated molecular patterns, but that's not what I'm going to talk about right now. The aluminium comes in, causes cell damage, secretes all the insides of cells, which alert the immune system and bring those substances that it came and encountered, including the aluminium and the stuff that leaked out of cells, and brings it to what's called an antigen-presenting cell. That antigen-presenting cell then starts to secrete its own cytokines and will call in T cells. These T cells will then recruit other generations of cells to either inflame, to clean up a mess, because sometimes inflammation is good. It actually helps clean up problems and kill bacteria and dead flesh and remove that dead flesh. And then you need the anti-inflammatory arm to come along and silence that. But what happens with aluminium is that this pro-inflammatory response, which is a Th17, gets set off. This one here, which is a T follicular helper cell system, gets set off. And this one here, the humoral immunity, which is the side that antibodies are secreted and can be associated with allergies, also gets set off. And this is very well documented and established in molecular biology that this Th2 system is skewed and biased after the exposure to aluminium. And it's actually the basis for why they use it in vaccines. So these infiltrating cells that come in here, these phagocytes here, they will come in and they will have an unlimited diet of aluminium. Now, that's different than if you get a cut on your skin that can be dealt with and it's done and over with. These persistent particles continue to stimulate this process and set off an oxidative stress bonfire in the skin, in the system, and causes massive amounts of inflammation. These cells will eat until they die, and then they will release their various substances and continue that process. This is just a better schematic of what happens in the cell. So this is the aluminium adjuvant. That's what it's called, adjuvant, meaning that it helps the vaccine have its inflammatory response. We have cell damage because where that needle goes makes all the difference. And whether there's a needle or not makes all the difference when it comes to aluminium. I'm just going to step aside and just explain this top part for a minute. Because the other thing that we hear on websites like Dr. Paul Offit's is that we shouldn't be worried about aluminium because it's a very abundant metal in the Earth's crust and we're eating it and drinking it all the time and it's in our baked goods and we shouldn't be worried about it. Well, when you eat aluminium, you absorb somewhere between 0.2% and 1.5% of it, okay? When you inject aluminium, you absorb 100% of it. Now, you can inject it in two ways. You can put it directly into a blood vessel, which is how the one study that they use for injection did it, put it right into intravenously. Well, you don't get this happening when you put that into a blood vessel. You don't have that kind of cell damage and all this inflammatory response when you put it into a blood vessel. The trick is to inject it into a muscle, and that's why vaccines are delivered into muscles, because the goal for a vaccine, an injected intramuscular vaccine, is to put this adjuvant in there with a particle of either a virus or bacteria and set off an immune reaction that hopefully your cells will remember when they're encountered with that same microbe in the future. So remember that intramuscular is key to causing the damage that I'm talking about here. Now, drinking it is still not a good idea, but you need a lot more of it to become toxic as long as you have normal kidney function. Okay, so this adjuvant is injected. You get the cell damage, and what happens when you get cell damage is that the cells usually will just break open. Those membranes will open, and their contents will spill out. Well, it turns out that some of the contents inside of cells are designed to be inflammatory. It's almost like an acid in there because you want it to be there if you want it to take in a microbe and dissolve it. But what you don't want to happen is for those cells to then break open and cause more inflammation in the body. And that can happen sometimes, which is why we need all those antioxidants in our diet and in our bodies. But normally, that shouldn't be going on and on and on. But what happens here is that the cell breaks open, ATP comes out, DNA comes out, uric acid comes out. These phagolysosomes break open and spill their contents, all highly inflammatory, okay? So then you're calling in more immune cells and more T helper cells to come in and deal with the problem. They come in and they encounter more aluminum. And it's basically a vicious cycle that continues to go on until the body can finally get on top of it. And in some vaccines, it's actually worse than others. We're finding that in the Gardasil vaccine, this is a big problem, and that these dendritic cells that get activated, sometimes they don't shut off and this inflammation continues. So the dose of the aluminium, the state, the anti-inflammatory state that it's injected into, and where in the body it's injected is really important. Needle into muscle is what's key. So if anyone wants to argue with you about aluminium, ask them about the different routes of how it can come into the body. Well, it's presumed that aluminium is safe because it's been used in food and vaccines for 70 years, not because it's been tested against placebo and people followed out for long term, but just because it's been done for so long. Because of that, it continues to be added to the vaccine schedule with callous disregard for the many mechanisms of cell injury and the vast medical literature on its toxicity when it's injected, especially. In America, we are giving our babies their first dose of aluminium during pregnancy, and then we're giving them the second one on day one of birth when they get 250 microgram shot. And then just like you do here, we start off with the 1,200 microgram doses. That boy that I was presenting today, he got 8 different antigens on one day, 3 times in a row. That was a huge aluminium load that he got. And by the time babies are 18 months old, they're getting around 4,925 micrograms brought into their bodies. Well, there's one really important detail that's almost always left out of the discussion when it comes to aluminium, whether it's injection or ingestion, and that is, what is the kidney function of the person that has taken it in? Well, we know over history that when aluminium is in dialysis fluids, that those patients get really sick, their bones get sick, their brains don't function properly, and it's a big problem. You know, we worked really aggressively to get that aluminium out of the dialysis water before giving dialysis. It's that important if you don't have normal kidney function. Now, if you've got any degree of kidney dysfunction, chances are the aluminium is not going to be excreted as if you have 100% of kidney function. Well, who has low kidney function? It turns out that infants don't have the same percentage when you compare it using the same measurements as adults have, and that premature infants have really low kidney clearance. So, you know, to do these calculations and reassure parents that everything is fine because we've injected aluminium into one adult man intravenously and he got rid of it all, we can't reassure parents about injecting it into their newborns or their babies, because normal kidney function is about 90 mLs per minute per 1.73 meters squared. We have ways of measuring that. And that's just the standard consideration, that greater than 90 is considered normal. Well, when a premature baby is born, it's around 20. And then we can see over here that as time goes on, the average, what we call glomerular filtration rate, or the clearance of substances through the kidney that need filtration, and a 2 to 8 day old average is only around 40. And that it ranges from 17 to 60. So some of them have actually really low clearance. And they never check to see what it is before injecting aluminium in these babies. And you can see that even up to 2 to 12 years, they say, it can only be on a low level, on the low range here, 89. But on average, up to 6 months, most kids don't have their kidney function up to speed.
You've been listening to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys discuss just one ingredient, aluminum, in vaccines. Now, if you were to review the literature, the scientific literature, the toxicology literature, which I'm advocating the people wanting to challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines, even if you believe the vaccines are good, but you want them spaced out over a long period of time, like many countries in the world, you want them used after the age of 3, not before. And their sudden infant death syndrome levels go down to 0 compared to ours as a percentage. We have the highest sudden infant death syndrome of any country in the developed world because we give the most vaccines. So we didn't talk about mercury. We didn't talk about polysorbate, formaldehyde, embalming fluid. We didn't talk about all the different mediums, the oncogenes, the cancer-causing genes, the bacteria, the viruses, that they cannot get out of these vaccines. These are extraordinarily contaminated vaccines. We only talk about one item and how dangerous it is. And that they, what I thought was particularly interesting is how she challenged the author directly of a report saying, oh, aluminum's not a problem. Think of the stupidity of that for a moment. And it really is stupid. You say, oh, good. You know, we didn't see any aluminum pass out of the body. And she, okay, if it didn't pass out, it wasn't metabolized. You can't metabolize heavy metals. Where'd it go? Well, it can only be stored in the tissue or the bones. So which organs can it be stored in? How about the brain? Okay, then why would you think that's a good thing when you have aluminum stored in the brain, knowing that it's a neurotoxin? Aluminum, at what one part per billion can destroy, as does mercury, ethyl mercury, can destroy neurons. And in the gut of a child, it can also destroy mitochondria. So what do we see in autistic children? We see disruptive mitochondria in the brain, disruptive mitochondria in the gut. So she's right on. Now, we have advocated that a panel of physicians and scientists who can debate Paul Offit and any group of scientists that he would select on the subject of safety and efficacy. They refused the debate. We've asked them. I've asked to debate Paul Offit. So, and then we asked, could we, those of us who are in the public health sphere, my PhD is in human nutrition and public health science, let us come and debate. Let us present information. And they won't do it. The only people that they allow are the pro-vaccine people who are hand-selected. So in California and in all the other states, because you're going to have this battle in all states, use the information. We have 6 hours up on our archives, plus 33 articles. And by the way, I'm almost finished with a major article on the history of vaccines, showing you the truth about vaccines overcoming smallpox and polio. I've completely deconstructed that argument using public health scientific articles throughout history. Neither is true. The smallpox vaccine did not eradicate smallpox, and the polio vaccine did not eradicate polio, and we will be able to prove it, fully referenced, all the citations, and we will put that out there next week. But right now we're out of time, and I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen, and I'll get to the other issues. I didn't have a chance to today, but I thought this was important. We listened to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys because I know that we do have very concerned people, individuals and parents in California who will take just that comment, that 20 minutes we just played, and present it to their legislators. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day. Volare. Oh, cantare. Oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare lassù.